Chapter 27. Chartering Evolves in California, a Policy Redwood. But when you get to say, now it's gone to California, the biggest state in the country and a union stronghold, and it was authored by a Democrat and signed into law by a Republican, it really gave it a lot more leg. Eric Premack. February to September, 1992. By early 1992, a robust debate about school choice was underway in the California legislature and in the education and business communities. Voucher advocates were mobilizing, this time with major funding from a top business leader. They hoped to go to the ballot in fall 1992 with a referendum initiative that would entitle parents to vouchers worth $2,500 annually for every school-age child. Parents could use these publicly funded vouchers to send their children to any school, public or private. As California State Senator Gary Hart, a chartering proponent, later wrote in the September 1996 issue of Cap'n magazine, this was not a modest voucher pilot proposal, but a full-blown effort to reconstitute public education in California. The voucher referendum threat in California had surfaced as early as the previous summer. It motivated state education leaders like Hart, Superintendent Bill Honig, and Assemblymember Delane Easton to search for education reform alternatives to propose for the 1992 legislative session. Not coincidentally, Ted Coldery had connected in Washington, D.C. with a California business leader who invited him to talk to the California Business Roundtable Education Committee. Coldery called Eric Premack, his longtime friend who had worked with the Citizens League and who was then a legislative analyst at the California legislature, to suggest that Premack set up meetings in Sacramento with legislators and others during his trip. The visits were successful. Said Coldery, they saw chartering as a way to generate innovative new schools and to catalyze the system, but within the general framework of public education. On the same day of the Coldery visits, Premack received phone calls from staff members for both Democratic chairs of the education committees saying, "We want to run a chartered school bill." During this time, Coldery also enlisted John Schrader's help in circulating information about U.S. Senator David Durenberger's chartering bill to a list of key Californians. One of them was Republican Governor Pete Wilson. Durenberger and Wilson were close friends, having served together for 12 years in the U.S. Senate. Durenberger wrote a personal letter to Wilson to encourage him to support state legislation in California on chartered schools. Coldery knew that passing chartering in a state like California would have great impact across the nation. As Premack explained in his May 2011 interview, certain states have certain reputations. Minnesota's is sort of the policy hothouse, where they get to grow interesting things that won't grow anywhere else or that are difficult to transplant, sort of policy orchids, if you will. But if you can do it in California, then it's a policy redwood. It's big and undeniable. When you say something happened in Minnesota, people say, "Isn't that cute?" and roll their eyes a little with a degree of admiration, but it's an "it'll never fly here in Jersey" kind of reaction. But when you get to say, now it's gone to California, the biggest state in the country and a union stronghold, and it was authored by a Democrat and signed into law by a Republican, it really gave it a lot more leg, in my experience, in shopping the idea to other states. Spurred by the growing threat of the voucher ballot initiative, the chairs of the education committees in both houses of the California legislature held a joint press conference on February 1, 1992, to publicly propose their respective chartered school bills. Hart proposed SB 1448, Easton proposed AB 2585. Unlike in Minnesota, where Representative Becky Kelso and I worked from one bill, these were two very different and competing bills. The bills differed in their approaches to chartering, and chartering supporters felt Hart's was the stronger bill. Wilson favored Hart's bill as well. Hart's proposed bill was similar to the Minnesota law, except that it allowed a local school board to approve a charter without needing second approval from the state board. Easton's proposed bill was more prescriptive and union-friendly, requiring sign-off by collective bargaining agents and a second approval by the state. Hart wanted to authorize 100 chartered schools. Easton's bill authorized 25. Underlying these differences were the politics of ambition. As both legislators were unannounced candidates to run for state superintendent in 1994. Also, Easton was up for re-election the coming fall, Hart was not. Despite the differences in the bills, what was most important is that both came from Democratic education leaders who were committed to introducing a positive reform alternative to blunt the appeal of the voucher plan. In California, no legislator could afford to take the electorate for granted on ballot initiatives. As Premack so colorfully said, the voucher ballot initiative gave some color to Democrats like Hart to walk out on the charter plank. It's what I called a crazy grandma strategy. If you have a crazy grandma in the attic, then our idea looks that much more sane. To keep chartering out of the political crossfire of the upcoming state superintendent election, Premack helped Hart and Easton reach an unusual deal. They would allow one another's bills to go through the entire legislative process largely unscathed, and then let a conference committee work out any differences. The handshake deal was that neither bill would emerge from the conference without the concurrence of both legislators. First, of course, they had to get their bills to the conference committee. Hart and his staff assistant, Sue Burr, worked to keep their bills simple and with few restrictions, allowing as much flexibility as possible for chartered schools. As Hart and Burr described in their September 1996 article in Cap'n Magazine, the first hurdle was the Senate Education Committee, where they needed 6 votes to pass the bill. As they met with committee members prior to the April 8th hearing, they were reminded of how confusing the chartering concept was and of the need for a sharp, clear message. So, instead of focusing on how chartering worked, they focused on how the current educational system worked. They wrote, "To drive home the message that schools needed much greater flexibility, we hauled the 11-volume, 6,000-page education code to the committee hearing and stacked it on the table in a 3-foot pile. This graphic display, with its implication of schools being crushed under prescriptive statutes, proved to be quite powerful, and after an extremely lengthy and contentious hearing, the bill passed out of committee by a vote of 6-5. Hart allowed very few amendments to his bill. As he and Burr wrote, if we weren't careful, we would end up reinventing that 11-volume education code we used so effectively as a prop. Hart had long been interested in creating more flexibility for public schools. As noted in the Cap'n article, he previously authored legislation for a program that granted approximately 200 schools greater flexibility in exchange for greater accountability. He also sponsored a statewide pupil achievement test to ensure that schools given more freedom would still be held accountable through the use of a standard measurement tool. To Hart, a move toward charter schools seemed to be a natural evolution of the education reform process. As Premack told it in his interview, Hart had been growing weary of complaints from district staff and superintendents who said they couldn't do anything outside the box instructionally, even with these new powers granted by Hart's sponsored programs. Premack explained, to him, in part, chartering was sort of throwing down a challenge to school districts. Okay, if the restructuring bill that I ran a few years ago wasn't powerful enough to let you do what you need to do, we're going to give you the waiver to end all waivers in the form of a chartered school bill. Hart's focus on in-district innovation was a primary reason why California became the first state to consider conversion chartering, a process whereby teachers of an existing district school could petition to convert into a chartered school. In Minnesota, we hadn't really thought about this option. We were focused on creation of new schools. According to Premack, I think Hart anticipated a certain number of from-scratch charters, but I don't think he anticipated the number and emphasis of from-scratch schools that we actually did see. I think his anticipation at the time was that a lot of this would be done by existing school staff and perhaps board members who wanted to push the envelope. Already, the concept of chartering was evolving. I had long thought chartered schools could be laboratories for innovation. But the idea that the chartered school law itself might be the focus of innovation hadn't really occurred to me. No doubt, though, it was front and center to Coldery, who had always focused on the innovation of chartering as a concept rather than on the innovations within the chartered schools themselves. The two competing chartering bills were winding their way through the legislative process to the conference committee, where the goal was to work out the differences and produce a final bill. Ironically, the voucher ballot initiative, which had stimulated the chartering activity in the first place, failed to get enough signatures by the April 27th deadline, so it would not appear on the November 1992 ballot. Would this remove the urgency for passage of chartering legislation? Would the unions become more aggressive in their opposition to chartering and try to kill it? The day of the conference committee arrived. As Premack described it, "We all go into the conference committee and they start going through the bills, issue by issue. It is pretty clear they're not going to reconcile these big differences. I assumed at the time that it wasn't going to happen that year in California. The politics aren't happening, and the differences between these bills are so profound." At that point, the education aide to Speaker of the Assembly, Willie Brown, walks into the room and whispers into Easton's ear and the ears of all other Assembly Democrats on the conference committee. They recess. Premack said, "We didn't know what was going on, but with Willie being really tight with the California Teachers Association, we figured it was no good." They come back after the recess, and they essentially slam dunk and pass Easton's bill out of committee and allow the bill later that day to pass the assembly. Not only did we not get our bill, but we have the concept caught in the superintendent political crossfire. We've got this bad bill hanging out there, which is worse than having no bill out there. So I thought it was just a lousy day. This was all going on amidst the backdrop of a huge budget deficit in California. Most thought the chartering war between the two bills was now settled, and legislators were now working on the budget. But Senator Hart wasn't quite done. Premack continued the saga. "I remember a nighttime session on the budget. I'm standing outside the Senate chamber watching a couple TVs. They were trying to slam dunk a budget that night. There was a lull on the floor. Gary Hart stood up and said, 'Mr. President pro tem, I ask for unanimous consent to bring my bill, SB 1448, back from conference committee.'" Premack didn't think much of it. He thought Hart was bringing the bill back for the next year of the biennium, a routine procedure. "I wasn't paying close attention," said Premack. "Nobody was paying close attention." Then Hart continued, "I also asked for unanimous consent to adopt the assembly amendments to my bill." Again, Premack thought, "Not a biggie. The amendments were pretty innocuous because of the deal we had. I thought, he's just doing a little cleanup on the floor while he can," and I again thought nothing of it. Finally, Senator Hart said, "I ask for unanimous approval of the measure and for immediate transmittal to the governor's desk." Now Premack was baffled. "I thought, what the? I had no idea. At that time, I could see some business cards floating down in front of the television camera. What I later learned is some of the education lobbyists up in the gallery were writing no on the back of their business cards." What Premack learned was that Burr and her boss, Education Committee Chief of Staff Bill Whiteneck, were pissed off that Easton had reneged on their handshake deal at the behest of Brown's education aide. According to Premack, they were grousing about it when another senator, known as the in-house guru on parliamentary procedures, said, "Why don't you just call the bill back if you haven't really amended it much?" He explained how to do that. Shortly thereafter, Hart came out on the floor and, at a quiet time, slid it through. This parliamentary handspring was possible because of the unusual deal the two committee chairs had struck. Basically, both chartering bills had gone through both houses, largely untouched, and therefore were both primed to go to the governor. As Premack relayed the story, "I'm standing outside watching this on the television screen, and it's hard to hear because everybody's talking about budget stuff. Glee Johnson, who was Governor Wilson's key staffer on education policy, walked out of the Senate chamber door, and she's smiling ear to ear. I still thought Hart was just bringing the bill back for reconsideration the following year of the biennium. I didn't quite get what this unanimous consent and immediate transmittal was about, and why the governor would be involved at this point in the process. Glee came up to me and gave me a big hug, and I said, 'What the hell's going on, Glee?' 'It's out.' 'What do you mean it's out?' 'I'm taking the bill to the governor's desk right now.' 'You have the actual bill?' 'Yes. It's been signed as passed in both houses. I just got this from the chief clerk's desk.' 'But the Easton bill is out too,' I said, still thinking about this conference committee deal. Glee rolls her eyes and says, 'What do you think the governor is going to do with that bill?'" Premack smiled as he remembered the story. He knew the governor disliked Easton. They had great personal animosity. He concluded, "So Glee took the bill to the governor's office, he signed it, and vetoed the Easton measure. And boom!" Chartering was passed in California. Wilson signed the bill on September 20, 1992. The chartering bill would become effective on January 1, 1993. 10 months after that, in November 1993, the voucher initiative would finally make its way to the California ballot, only to be rejected by the California electorate by a margin of almost 2-1. By the time of the chartered school bill signing, Premack had left his job as a legislative staff member and was working as a consultant. Inundated with requests for assistance, Premack turned his attention to chartering. As predicted, the California chartering legislation had national impact. Now there were three lead voices spreading the word on chartered schools across the nation, from Minnesota, Washington, D.C., and California. The chartering trifecta of Coldery, Schrader, and Premack would eventually help write chartering laws in over half the states. But first, things weren't going so well in Washington, D.C.